We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home. This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that I give them any shade. But every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy.
And they don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with
your... Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You'll just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
Sign up now on patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com to get this episode and every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast ad-free, along with bonus episodes, our Discord community, and so much more. Sign up now at patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com and we'll see you over there.
Going along, and they come to a Y junction where there's a kind of a grass. So if you go to the Y junction, there's like a grass triangle in the middle of that junction. And there's no signpost or anything, so they slowed right down to see where to go. And at that moment, on the grass junction bit, appeared this what he described as like a bollard of foliage. It suddenly appeared. It had a head and a body, a very tightly wound foliage. And as he drove past slowly, this thing turned to look at them as they drove. And Sharla, his wife, saw eyes looking back at them from this foliage. So they both saw it. She initially let out an expletive and he slammed on the brake and they both said, "Did you see that?" And they'd both seen it. And I think he kind of stopped for a moment to gather his senses and then he just kind of put his foot on the accelerator and he was out of there because he was absolutely terrified. She says that she wasn't frightened, but she was shocked because she said she'd had experiences before, like stuff where, have I seen something? Haven't I? Oh, I'm not sure. It's probably nothing. But she'd never, ever had an experience like that with somebody else that saw it too. And so there was no escaping it. They both saw this being. And it has turned his life around in some respects because, as I say, he'd gone through all of this research of recent decades, just thinking, oh, it's just tradition, it's just folklore stuff. And actually, now he feels like he's on a mission to let people know that, no, it is true.
And you just heard today's guest, host of the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with today's guest, Joe Hickey Hall. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And joining me today is a fellow podcaster, although in a very unique lane of her own. And I'm so excited to join forces with her today for this podcast swapcast, if you will. The host of the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast, Joe Hickey Hall, joins us. Joe, it's a pleasure to host you here on my show, and I really enjoyed learning from you on your podcast. So for folks who might just be learning about you for the first time, give me a little introduction and tell us about how the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast came to be.
Thank you. And thank you for such a lovely, warm welcome. And I am absolutely delighted to be here. So, and your show is fantastic. So I was really looking forward to this. So Modern Fairy Sighting, that it came into being as a podcast in 2020. At the beginning of lockdown, I began to just kind of look after myself through meditation every day. And a project that I've been working on for since 2016, which was kind of looking at people's encounters with fairies. It just started to, I was kind of getting these really strong messages basically through meditation every day that I needed to make a podcast, which was completely out of my comfort zone. I had not even thought about that. And I think it's quite indicative because, as you all know, I'm sure those important things in life, they just kind of unfold. And I've never really kind of had a plan for whatever I've been doing. I've never actually had a plan. But fairies have kept coming into my life. So I think that's quite interesting, really. I never would have kind of set out to do any of the things that I'm doing now, but I couldn't be happier because it's really what I love doing. And I think I've always just done what I enjoy. And we've all been in situations where we're in jobs and situations where we feel like this is really not what I'm enjoying. And it's kind of hard to move away, isn't it? So I've definitely sort of gone through life and sensed where things are, doors are opening, or I feel like I'm in situations that I'm not enjoying, but I've always maintained in my life doing things that I actually love in my spare time. And this was something I was doing in my spare time. So I'd written a chapter in Simon Young's Magical Folk, which is a great book. And it was looking at fairies in Britain and Ireland from 500 AD to the present time. And I had the Devon chapter with Mark Norman, another folklorist, and we started to go down to Dartmoor to research. And we were going down to the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic, which I don't know if any of your watchers and listeners will be familiar with. It's a great place if you're ever down in Devon. Definitely go along there. They've got an incredible collection of esoteric paraphernalia. And we were doing the basic research, the literature research, but then we thought it would be really interesting to actually speak to local people and find out if people were actually still seeing fairies. And when I got back from that trip, I mean, I'd had my own fairy experience, so I knew what it was like for people, how hard it was to talk about these things. And what I found was very interesting when I was down there was that I'd arranged to speak to somebody and they would have the kind of official story that they wanted to talk to me about. But then they would kind of say to me quietly, oh, this is other one, but, you know, I don't want this to go out there. This is a bit of a weird one. But of course, that's the one that I really wanted to hear. And it is like that sometimes. We have these experiences which we just feel are too weird for. This was Stanton Drew Stone. So we went for a ceremony this morning, a Druid ceremony at Stanton Drew Stone Circle, which is... So this one I'm at is actually in Jersey. It's Val Duet Dolmen, which is my very special place in Jersey, where I'm from, in the Channel Islands. But where we were this morning was Stanton Drew, and it's the second biggest stone circle in the UK after Avebury. And so that's where we were. And I was Lady of the Spring. So that was pretty cool this morning, actually. It was really amazing.
I'm honored to have you on the show even more so then. Yeah. Well, let's continue.
So where was I? I was talking about the fact that people always have holding something.
Yes.
So yeah, a couple of times I'd met with some people and I think I was talking about I'd come back So when I came back from the Dartmoor trip, the Devon trip, the research trip, I thought it would be a really good idea to create a safe place where people could talk about their fairy experiences. Because, as I say, I had an experience. I had told my co-researcher about it during that trip. He hadn't known about it before. Funnily enough, the reason that I met him was because I'd gone to Bristol to study with Professor Ronald Hutton, which I'm sure many of your listeners and watchers will be a fan of Ronald's. He's one of the top kind of pagan experts in the world and is at Bristol University. So I had gone to study with him, and he had ended up being my supervisor for my master's. And he didn't know either about my experience with a little green man. But even though I had gone there to study sacred sites, I was hoping that actually my master's would be around ritual, what we know about ancient ritual around sacred sites. But for various reasons, he asked me to look at fairies, medieval Irish she. And so that's what I ended up doing my master's on. So again, it was like I'm in a situation where I've gone there to do one thing and I've been led to fairies. And then I've gone along to join the Folklore Centre, the Folklore Society, which is what he suggested to doing my master's, go along, meet people there. And that's where I met Mark. And because I was working with Ronald on fairies, he then asked me to write this chapter in this book. So this unfolding happening all the time. And I do think that is a pattern with all of this, that things have just unfolded in their own way. And so, long story short, that's kind of how I ended up doing what I'm doing now. I did then, I think I was about 6 months into the podcast, because I just kind of taught myself how to edit and what have you, and just got 3 interviews ready for that first part of the podcast. And I had no idea how it would be received. I just had no idea, but it just felt right. And when that went out, it seemed to really capture people's imagination. And I started to get emails from people saying how much it meant to them to hear people talk about these events that people don't usually feel able to express. I then, I think 6 months after that, spoke about my own experience, which had happened years and years before. But it was quite a big thing for me to talk about my own experience. So I really appreciate how hard it is for anybody to do that. It's got to feel right. And I think I always say to my guests, there's never any pressure to either A, talk about it, or B, if they do talk about it, to release that as an episode, because it would just be the worst thing to release something either before you're ready or if you don't think it's right for you to do so. Because some experiences, as we all know, are ones that they don't feel the kind that you want to share. They're just very private and personal ones that you want to keep. So it's not saying that everybody should be talking about their fairy experiences. But yeah, I love what I do.
Yeah, and it seems true to your experience that they're far more common than one might expect. And due to whatever societal pressure there may be, people are very hesitant to talk about these things. Hence the name of my show, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. I've always been interested in this stuff to a detriment, it might seem, at least if you listen to those around me. But yeah, I think despite myself not having any acute experiences with the unknown, at least that I remember, I mean, hey, I was a very rambunctious and wild kid. I went off on my own in the woods very often. So who knows, there could be some memory that I need to still regress out of me. But yeah, I've always had a reverence for these things. And I'm curious, was there a time, because you said you've spent your master's looking into the origin of these experiences, or at least the earlier experiences of fairies. Was there a time when these things weren't so taboo? Was there a time, at least in maybe Irish or English culture, when these things weren't so constrained by the church or politics?
I do believe there was. I mean, the church over centuries and centuries was stopping the people from venerating stones, going to groves in the wood and worshipping in their own way. I mean, you've got the councils for the Christian councils. You've got, I think it's Nicaea or Nicaea, and various other rules laid down by the church over centuries. And they obviously didn't work because they had to keep telling people, again, you mustn't be venerating these places. And they're even threatening local priests that if their parishioners, if their community do go and do this, that they will be held responsible. So I do think that you've always had this link with Otherworld, and we've always felt it in our bones, and we've always wanted to express that in our sense of connection with the divine. But yes, it has been pressed upon us that it's wrong, and it's absolutely not wrong. And I think we're starting to realize now, in my view, we're starting to realize what we've lost. That's not to say that, it's not to come down hard on the Christian church either, I have to say, because I think there were aspects that have been able to run through. I mean, I had a really nice interview with Brother Richard Hendricks around Christmas time. And from what he was telling me, aspects of the church were aware of the beauty of these experiences. And so there were pockets where people still continued to worship in their own way. So I think we've always officially, I think, where sort of power and control has been at play, we have been steered away from exploring our own direct connection with the divine. But if people start doing that, then they're not listening to the external power, they're listening to the power within them and the divine power that we all belong to. And so if there are power structures in place, they're going to want to dismantle that. So that's what we've seen. But as I say, at the same time, I think we have had this thread, it seems to me. I mean, it's very difficult to find evidence that will point back into deep ancient times and be able to say this is about fairies. But if you look at a lot of the cave art with the therianthropes, then you see these half man, half creature, half beast. And this could have been, obviously it's related to the shamanistic culture. It seems that way. And obviously we're starting to realize that. But you know, these shamans within their culture, they were connecting with the divine in their own way, and they were bringing back the wisdom for those communities in a way that a lot of cultures, indigenous cultures, still do. In pockets, like the San Bushmen, there was still some evidence suggesting that this is what they did, because they were still doing this until sort of, I think, sort of around the sort of 70s or 80s, that they were still creating this art that seem to suggest that it stretched back over millennia to their ancestors. So we have these kind of little glimpses of what may have been. And I believe that we've been doing this forever. And the forms in which they appear seem to change over time. It's quite interesting that a lot of the beings, they look like Brian Froud artwork. Certainly the being that I saw looked like that. Some people do say that they see fairies with wings. There's a great, if people are interested, they can look up Dr. Simon Young's Investigation Society, and he's been running a fairy census since the first lot covered 2017 to perhaps 2021, something like that. And I think he's now collecting the third lot of census. There's been two that have been released. And so in that census, you can search within it and you'll find that people had been seeing fairies with wings for the last kind of 100 years. Another really good book, which again, Dr. Simon Young had edited, this was a lost work by Marjorie T. Johnson. The book's called Seeing Fairies. And she was the original part of the original Fairy Investigation Society, which she joined in the 50s, but it had been running since the 20s or 30s. And it was kind of, it had come off the back of the kind of theosophy, interest in theosophy. And so in that book, in Seeing Fairies, when she was the secretary of the Fairy Investigation Society, she was actually then writing to newspapers and magazines and asking people for their stories. And in that book, there are lots of encounters that people describe seeing what they called kind of elemental, kind of nature elementals. So it is interesting that you've got ideas of fairies with wings in this kind of modern era, if you like, but they didn't really appear much in our artwork until a couple of centuries before that. You've got things like cherubs appearing in artworks, but with wings, but that's not strictly the same as fairies. So I think that these beings seem to have taken different forms in our imagination, I guess. But there have been these kind of archetypes, like, for instance, the Dark Man, which my colleague Dara Mason from, oh, you spoke to Dara, right? So yeah, so people can just refer back to the episode with you then to hear more about
yours. You guys had a great conversation on your podcast as well. And if I could just jump in, you're giving me so many points. I've been taking notes. Seeing Fairies, I'll have to look into that book. Mentioned Brother Richard, and I wanted to touch on that interview because I was really moved by that conversation and his take. He's a Franciscan brother, and I think it was something along the lines of, if man can imagine it, then God has imagined it already, right? And this was sort of his, and I'm paraphrasing, but in a very poetic way, logically speaking, these beings are somehow in the Christian paradigm, I guess was his way of putting it. And yeah, I think we need to start to unbox these things and take them out of these paradigms. The way you're describing it is kind of reminiscent of Joshua Cutchin and his work, and we've both spoken with him. And yeah, I think he's kind of touching on this point you're making about fairies reflecting our cultural values or the way we perceive our environment. But when it comes to the earliest depictions, they might not have been images, but what are some of the earliest ideas of fairies? What folk can we look for or look to for that sort of information? Where's the earliest record of these beings?
Well, I guess, I mean, you do have the medieval Irish, the tales, and in those tales, I mean, they are just really crazy stories about the feet of these otherworldly beings. But what's interesting in those stories is that the idea back then, and of course, these would have been scribed by Christian scribes at the time. So that's interesting in itself that they've actually written about this. And there's a sense that these were probably oral traditions that got written down. But what really comes through in that is that they lived in a parallel world to ours. And to be honest, that's kind of where I'm at with the research that I'm doing, is that it does appear to me that they are living in a parallel world to ours, and that every now and then we step into theirs and they step into ours. And it will be when the saying, the veil is thin. Well, those can be times of year, like now, today's equinox. So the equinoxes, the solstices, and the festivals, will particularly Beltane and Samhain, so May Day and what we know as Halloween. But also this thin time we're living through, because we're going through this transitional period from, some might argue, the old world, the old structures, to the new, what we're creating going forward. And I think that if you look back at the sense that is portrayed in those stories, that the fairies might appear in, say, bird form or other forms, and that they were these shape-shifting beings, and that they had a deep, really deep effect on whoever the character of the story was. They would have a deep effect on their lives. And I think that, again, is what I'm finding in my research, is that when people have interactions with these beings, even if they are frightening experiences, that there will be some kind of sense of epiphany, or they will get to reflect on their lives in some way, or they will kind of, if it's a frightening experience, sometimes they might kind of push through that fear. And it's a bit like pushing through a membrane, in the same way as being born, in effect. You are shifting from one state to another. And so I think that you've got those kind of old texts, and then you've got, you know, the Irish folklore is very rich because they weren't industrialized in the same way as the UK, for instance. And also their religion, we didn't have the kind of Reformation like we did, where everything was demonized in Ireland, in order to get the local people to accept the new religion coming in. They encompassed all of the old ways within them. And so the springs, the old sacred springs, then became Christianized and dedicated to various saints and what have you. So in effect, the communities were still able to worship these places in their old ways to a degree. They at least still remained important parts of their community. So if you look at, for instance, the Ducas, i.e. the school's collection, which is available freely online, and it is a collection of folklore from the 1930s. And cleverly, what happened was, or wisely, the schools had asked the children to go home to speak to the eldest relative and to bring the stories back, whether they were folk tales, whether they were just interesting snippets about the history of around where they lived, or their own encounters. And so a really rich resource for looking back at how people used to, what their beliefs and traditions were. So we have that. And we do have a number of sources from Ireland. Crofton Croker, Thomas Crofton Croker is really interesting too. It got to about the kind of late, 18th century, well, late 18th century, early 19th century onwards, people seem to be starting to collect these experiences again. So you do have some really juicy collections of encounters in various places like Wales and Ireland, and a little bit in the UK as well. So I can't remember what you were asking me now.
You certainly got us into a good direction, but no, I was sort of asking about the origins of these concepts and maybe even how they've developed over time. I know there are many different, I guess you would say, classifications of fairy beings. We can think of gnomes, brownies, the classic fairy, but are these all byproducts of the modern age? How true are some of these images of the various fairy types? Is there modern encounters with the variety of beings? I know from books I've read that certain fairies like to be in certain areas, like they sort of have like distinct qualities that match their environment, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it does work like that to a certain degree, but I'm not kind of, in my own research, I'm not pushing categories as such, but there are some that seem to have defined characteristics. Our categorization of fairies, it's a very sort of Victorian way of understanding, isn't it? And these taxonomies, while they are useful and interesting, I feel we might just be using different words to describe, different names to describe the same beings. I think you just get a sense of their character more than anything. And so I'm kind of reluctant to produce categorizations as such. But what I will say is that beings to do with water seem to be often the most kind of dangerous. And that seems to come up again and again in my research and speaking to people, that there are also these beings who are tree beings. They look like they're made of branches, made of sticks, made of trees. These are really interesting types of beings that I would like to learn about more. I had actually seen one myself in Jersey. And then I spoke to a guy as part of my research, one of the first few interviews that I did, and he had seen one in the UK. And since then, I've spoken to quite a few other people who also have seen, well, not quite a few, a handful of people that have seen new beings. And there's one or two in Dr. Simon Young's fairy census too. So that kind of emerging for me, I mean, they seem to look, people are kind of likening them to the Ents, if you like, from Lord of the Rings. But they seem, their nature seems similar when people talk about them. They seem very shy. They run or move very awkwardly. And so there are these details that emerge from the research that I'm interested in, but I'm not necessarily interested in sort of getting that then and sticking it into a category and say, oh, well, that's that then. Because I just don't know. We just don't know. And while we have been used to doing that, I'm not sure. For me, it doesn't feel helpful to do that. For me, I just want to see how they arise within the research, and then just kind of get talking to people about it and see how these characteristics come up in their experiences with these beings. So we might be looking at a different way to meet these beings. Certainly the little green man that I saw, which people would describe him as a gnome or maybe a brownie, depending on where you are, because if people's idea of brownies is that usually that they're in the home and they will be helpful. And so you have ideas, people will say, oh, I have a brownie in the house, or there are tales written of people's experiences from a long time ago with brownies in their houses. But somebody else might have called that a fairy. Somebody else might have called it a hobgoblin. We just are using different words sometimes to just describe certain beings. But the being that I saw, he looked like a gnome in the idea of what we think of as a gnome. But he was looking after, it seems to me anyway, looking after this particular piece of land. The reason I say that is because I spoke to another woman who saw a being that sounds just like him. I mean, it just sounded like the same being in that same place within just a few meters or just meters of where I had seen him. And this was some years later that she saw him. So when you look at that, to me, that feels like a genius loci of that place. And so I don't know what to call him. I mean, I'm not sure. I've just referred to him as the green man. And of course, it's not the green man that we think about in folklore and artworks, but more just a small green being that we might say would look like what we quite imagine a gnome to look like.
Right.
With a very face, rounded features, very ancient face, dressed in those kind of archetypal Brian Froud type figures do wear, with the sort of different layers of clothing. The man I saw was wearing very green layers of clothing and some kind of hat, and almost a little bit tatty clothing. But yeah, so in quite a lot of people see these types of beings, and then some other people will meet what appear to be human beings, but it's not quite right, and there's something otherworldly about them, and strange things will happen in their presence, or they will be able to get to a certain place where it would just been physically impossible for them to do that, or they will say something that is just very, very will strike them at a very deep place in their core, or they will have a sense of dread when they meet them So there are these stories of what people might have thought were human beings, and they appear to be some kind of fairy being. But for the purpose of my research, I'm kind of counting it all in as fairies. Other people might do it a different way, but I'm interested in all of it. I'm interested in otherworldly beings. And so kind of giving that the umbrella term of fairies, but really, I don't know. None of us know what they are, but otherworldly seems to fit.
Yeah. No, I think you're right on the nose there. And that's a great approach to holistically understand these. And if they are, as you use the term genus loci, which I think is a big factor in all these experiences, maybe they reflect the qualities of the landscape. They reflect the quality of the culture or the people in that landscape. And then maybe even to some degree reflect your own observation, this sort of observer effect, not to take it into the realm and reduce it to materialism, because I really abhor that take. But I think we have to be able to balance the science and the spirituality and sort of use both to our advantage, which is, yeah, the approach that you seem to be taking there, the holistic approach, and saying that there's some commonality here that we can't dismiss despite the distinctions in these experiences. But as far as your encounter with this little green man, can you tell us a little bit more about what some of the parameters of that experience were? What time of day, what time of your life? Were there any other significant factors that might have come into play with that experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing to say, and this is really important, is that I had just, so that happened some way into 2007. I had met my husband in October 2006. And in May 2005, I had a very profound healing experience where I always say there was my life before that, and then there was my life since then. It was like Martin, it's Martin Brofman. I was studying with the body mirror system of healing. And it was like he turned the on switch, basically. And yeah, so life was very different after that. And I believe that my third eye was just completely open then. I mean, not all the time, obviously, but that I had a very profound experience right after that class when I was walking back to the station to get back to where I was staying. And it was just like a trip, really. It was amazing. And it felt like I had one foot in either world. I wasn't quite in the material. It was really quite incredible. So since then, everything shifted for me. And as I say, I met who was to be my husband the following year. And I was with my husband, Peter, when this happened. So we were at a place where we went to watch the sun go down. And we had a picnic with us. And so it was getting on to twilight. It wasn't very difficult to, it definitely wasn't dark. It would have been getting on for later in the day, but I don't think it was twilight, but it was approaching that sort of time. So there you've got big life changes, as in having met my husband. This was the point at which we were really falling in love. So I feel like that was the kind of threshold. Then the time of day, and where we were was very close to the ocean. So you've got between land and sea, another liminal place. So I feel like that definitely had some kind of bearing on, I feel very strongly, in fact, that the strength of feeling between myself and my husband is what maybe drew him in, because we were embraced when he appeared. So I always felt, oh, he was there, kind of, he had seen me, because when we locked eyes, it felt like he was just as curious to see me as I was to see him. Yeah, it was an amazing moment. See, I think those were very important that was significant in the experience. Yeah. And the other significance that I'm realizing more and more now that I'm doing this is that the one thing that I came away from that experience with was that he wanted me to see him. And that was that was the only certain thing I walked away from. So that's what I can say. Is trying to make sense of that is a bit impossible when it's first happened in particular. And it takes you some time to just work through what you've just experienced. And I didn't really for a while. But the immediate thing I had was that he'd wanted me to see him. And now with what I'm doing, it makes sense that maybe that was something to do with this, with what I'm doing. So,
yeah.
And I don't know. That's just a feeling.
No, intuitively, I think it makes a lot of sense. The alchemy of human relationships, the actual spiral nature of the heart and how in concert two hearts create this huge magnetic field of attraction. I think that makes a ton of sense. And especially considering your recent healing transformation. I mean, yeah, you are not only emanating that energy, but you are on that level of awareness to receive that. Yeah, wow, that's incredible. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors, and then we'll be right back to this episode with today's guest. Remember, if you want every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast ad-free and interruption-free, sign up on Patreon, patreon.com/MFTIC, or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. All right, so first and foremost, my favorite new sponsor is Above Phone, who's helping you step above big tech with their friendly apps, operating systems, and communications that give you privacy and control. It's a phone that does everything you want and more. It's not going to spy on you, and you're in luck because now you have a promo code CRAZY, you can save when checking out one of your Above Phone laptop or tablet. That's right. They've even got the full suite. If you're comfortable with what you are working with already, you can download their privacy suite into your existing system and be completely encrypted. Go and check it out today. Abovephone.com. Use the promo code CRAZY. I mean, think about it. All of the things you're researching, if you're listening to a podcast like this, don't you want to have 100% anonymity? Anonymous searching. They're not going to track your GPS location. They're not going to listen to you through your phone and suggest ads. I mean, what a world. This feels like going back in time 15 years. So, yeah, very cool stuff. Go and check it out. Abovephone.com, promo code CRAZY. And then secondly, my favorite sponsor, Brain Supreme, the number one microdosing option in today's new market of microdosing mushrooms. All kinds of crazy stuff is available out there. And you need to go to a trusted source. I trust Brain Supreme. I've spoke to the creator, the founder, Adam Schell, on the podcast multiple times. You can go and listen to my interviews with him. That's Adam Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L. And the Brain Supreme supplements are not just mushrooms. It's a comprehensive nootropic blend. There are curcumin, ginger, really interesting stuff. They even have a brains and balls blend with tea boosting supplements in there. Aspartic acid, green tea extract, tonka, ali, ginseng, lion's mane, black pepper. It's all natural, 100% natural ingredients. So check it out, brainsupreme.co, promo code CRAZY. I love it. I know you'll love it. Check it out today. Let me know what you think. Promo code CRAZY. Check out our affiliate sponsors in the episode description. Raw Optics for your blue light blocking lenses. The Hit Kit for your number one smoking gadget or all of your Orgonite needs. That's Orgonite. Orgonite made in the great state of Oregon. And the Aqua Cure, which I love. I just turned my Aqua Cure on and I love it. It's incredible. The health, the healing, the wonders of the Aqua Cure. Use the promo code CRAZY, and we'll be right back to this interview with Joe Hickey Hall in just a moment. ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about my favorite new sponsor. That's Mood. I love Mood because they're providing affordable, accessible, convenient, and transparent cannabis that's 100% legal and grown on small, pesticide-free American farms. That's right, American cannabis for American listeners. And it's 100% legal. They've got a full selection of cannabis products. I was a huge fan of their Tangy flower. Wow, it really brought me back to when I had first tried Tangy, and it was incredible. So if you have any doubts, try Mood for yourself, and I doubt you'll be disappointed. Use the promo code CRAZY and get 20% off your first order at mood.com. That's 100% federally legal cannabis, pesticide-free, delivered directly to your front door in a discreet package. Mood.com, promo code CRAZY, and trust me, folks, you're going to love this stuff. I give it the Mystic Mark guarantee. And Mood is going to back that up because not only do they stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you get 20% off your first order with promo code CRAZY. When life's song falters in the night and courage seems to drown, hymns lifts your spirit anew so desires can fully abound. For strength and passion to reign supreme when love's dance calls to play, hymns offers remedies that ignite your flame and help extend your stay. If dormant flames in passion's den leave your heart feeling withdrawn, hymns fuels the fire with ease and care, reviving where it's gone. When tailored cures to fan the spark, no doctor's door you need to seek, reclaim your confidence and zest through hymns' discreet technique. For men who face such silent storms within the heart's domain, hymns ushers comfort quietly with solutions that remain. Holy online bespoke to you, removing burdens, lightening strain. Renew yourself with whispered ease. Let passion's song again be free. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/crazy. The featured products include compounded products which are not approved nor verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality by the FDA. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Now, how common is it for those sorts of experiences? Because you were an adult when this took place. Because I think the common cliche is that children often see these entities. And children, we've all been children at one point in our life. And we remember the joy of being a kid, the sort of lightness and the wonder of it all, right? So kids are naturally in that state that is somewhere in that same realm as maybe the feeling that you get when you're in love, right? This overwhelming joy, this wonder. So there's sort of a similarity there, but is it common for adults to have these encounters? Maybe just as common as it is for children?
It's definitely more common than we think. There's so many people walking around that have had these experiences that just don't talk about them. Mm. But you're right, children are more open. And I think that you're right also to point out that it was after the healing experience, because after that, I was just allowing myself to see what I see. And so I was seeing the world in a very different way than I had before. And I was meeting the world in a different way. It was like totally different perceptual filter, completely changed. And children do that. They just trust, they see what they see, they say what they see. And they, unless they've been socialized early, then they are open to these experiences because they haven't yet been told that it's not right or not possible or whatever to see, to have these experiences. So yes, they certainly do. I mean, we've all, well, I'm assuming we've all, because everybody that I speak to has had either really strange dreams or some kind of weird experiences as a kid where you can all remember something. And so I think a lot of us, if we are able to, well, if we're in a family who kind of encourage our imagination, who get interested when we tell them about strange dreams or interesting experiences, then you might be able to kind of hang on to some of that, even though you're going to be socialized at school, you're going to be socialized by television and your peers and all the rest of it. If you're brought up in a family that kind of values these, is open-minded and values strange experiences or how amazing the world is, or then you might be able to carry that through into adulthood. And then again, there's some people that just never, ever thought that they would, they've never even thought about fairies before. And yet they have these incredible experiences. So yeah, I wonder what it is about those people that there's, I guess often when these experiences happen, they need to, for some reason, for them, for that person. And so there's this like a little chink of potential that something can maybe connect with you, then it will. And it might not even be a big kind of wow fairy experience. It might just be that you're sitting under a tree one day and you know, you have a beautiful moment with that tree or with an animal, whatever. Natural experiences with nature are just as rich. And I guess we don't always talk about that either. But I feel like it's just the same in that sometimes, and I know that a lot of us experienced this in lockdown, our connection to our local, whether it was a park or our garden or whatever, our relationship to that spot of nature became very important. And we all felt when we would go and have these moments in nature, how restorative it was. And it feels like if we're going through something, nature seems to reach out to us if we allow it to. And it's the same with these beings. They're just part of nature and they will reach out to us. And again, if we're open to it, then, you know, that happens. So I think that, yes, there are lots of adults walking around with kind of like questions in their mind as, oh, that really strange experience happened once, but you know, surely that was a dream, or I must have imagined that. Oh, it's a trick of the light. And something that does happen quite often is with the shape-shifting. People will often say, oh, I had this one time where I was walking through a forest and I saw a log, or they say that I saw a fairy. And then it changed into a log, or I saw a log and then it changed into a fairy and then back again. So they have these kind of questionable experiences where I feel like I saw that happen, but I'm just not sure. So there's definitely lots of those too. And I think that they are very common, I would say. I mean, I've come to the conclusion so far that I think everybody will know somebody that has had a fairy experience. I really believe that. But they probably, that person is probably likely not spoken of it.
Yeah. I think the connection to the land is so important, and maybe in places where there isn't that connection as easily available, you have a lack of these encounters. But I don't know. Maybe there are entities of their own that like urban environments. And I'm in a rural environment now and haven't done a census, but I can definitely feel the magic in the air when I go into the woods, and I get a sense that this is not a sort of domesticated space. It's a very wild space still, and it's exciting. I haven't seen anything that is worth mentioning aside from maybe a couple of odd animal encounters, which those may be, there may be something more to those, as you alluded to. These beings can shapeshift, but yeah, it is sort of, I think, a connection to our roots. When we enter into the forest, there's something really human about that, and that introspection that takes place, or the conscious connection that you can tap into by being in these spaces alone.
That's right. I mean, that there have been quite a number of experiences that people have had in urban areas too. It does happen. But even in with pockets of green, you can still have a connection with those little pockets of green, even if you're living in a city.
Right.
And so even if you had a plant on a windowsill, you could still form some kind of communication. In fact, thus spoke the plant by, I can't remember her name now. I've got such a terrible memory. Can you pause a second and I will find the book for you. Hang on a second.
You have it on the shelf?
I do.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
It's finding it though. You never see them. Just look up. I know her name. It's just... Oh yeah, Monica Gabbiano.
Okay.
So, just himself in. Yeah, there's a book by Monica Gagliano called Thus Spoke the Plant, and she ran a series of experiments kind of connecting with plants. It was part of an experiment. She's a scientist herself. And that's a very interesting book because it's showing that we do have this symbiotic relationship with plants. And so this is what I'm saying. If people can't get outside for any reason and they don't have any green areas around where they live, even just having a living plant in their home can foster a connection with nature. And also, I had a friend who became very ill, and he had always been so connected with these sacred places. And this behind me is Val d'Huy Dolmen in Jersey, which is a very special place to me, Jersey in the Channel Islands. And even though he couldn't get outside, he would use his mind, he would meditate, and he would go to these places. So that's something else that people can do. If you're feeling like, oh, you're never going to be able to get to these places, well, just try it. Just meditate and get yourself to a place where you can imagine being there and just trust what you find there. Just trust what you receive there, because it's very powerful. He had lost his sight, and so he was then visiting these places in his mind, because he couldn't get about as well either. But we have these ways that we can still connect with these other worlds, even if going to places in nature becomes physically difficult for us in some way. So hopefully that helps somebody who needs to hear that.
Yeah. Well, and these sites are far more available and widespread. Like I was saying at the beginning of our conversation, there are stone structures here in New England that are very similar to what are found in the British Isles and Northern Europe, these stone circles. And I think there's a liminal space that's demarked by these stone structures, and maybe even because of their properties, or that's conducting telluric energies, electric energies, or even maybe pointing us in the right direction to harness those celestial energies, they're inherently boundaries between the earth, space, the sky, the heavens, however you see it in your personal worldview. But I think these locations are like you were describing before, these liminal spaces where the veil is thin.
Well, that's a good point, because where I saw this being was actually very near a sacred dolmen.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was also very significant. And, yeah, people do have experiences and encounters around these places, whether they are white ladies or some other types of beings, whether they are fairy beings. You know, people do report having experiences around there, which is something I'd really like to get into studying at some point. I'm writing a book at the moment, but my next book will be about children's experiences after this book. And then after that, I think I'd like to concentrate on encounters at these types of spaces, because they are incredibly powerful. And they all have different resonance as well. It's very interesting. The one where I was just saying at the beginning, I've just been at the Stanton Drew Spring Equinox ceremony this morning. So if I'm a bit dithery, that's why, because I've been up since 5 a.m. and getting ready to get to this ceremony at 6:30 this morning, which was wonderful. And that place always makes me spin. I feel like I'm spinning when I'm there. And I never, ever had that experience at any of these dolmens in Jersey, just a completely different experience in Jersey. So they've all got their own qualities, and we just don't know enough about it at the moment, but I really hope that we get to learn more. I feel like we will. I feel as we're kind of leaning into these other worlds and what we have to learn from these beings, these places, I feel like we're going to learn more about, maybe hopefully, what the ancient people knew. And it certainly feels that way.
Yeah. I think it's going to take intuitively tapping into these sites and allowing the intuitive feminine side of our consciousness balance out the masculine scientific sort of, I think we've been over dominant in that area. Is it the left brain thinking, the sort of masculine projection onto the earth? And it's kind of led us to overlook some of the, I think, more important qualities that our earth allows us to tap into to create a more abundant, prosperous environment and community. I think this is a big indication when you're having these experiences of the health of the land itself. The Native Americans here in North America have several different similar, I guess, types of encounters. They don't use the term fairy, but not too far from me, they have these little people, they call them, called the Pukwudgi, I think is the official indigenous, their language's name for the being. But it's very similar to what you're describing with the gnome, where these are little benevolent beings and they appear to you at significant points in your life, and they're to be respected and protected, taken care of, because they sort of, in a way, are like the microcosm of the macrocosm. When they're alive and thriving, the entire environment around them is thriving. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to exist. The energy would be off.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think that we have always kind of, it feels this way to me anyway, that we've always had this relationship with them. So it's great to hear. I'd love to learn more about these beings in America. I did speak to some people that were experiencing kind of smaller, very fairy type little beings that I haven't heard about these types in the UK. So I'm quite intrigued to learn more about the kinds of beings over there. So perhaps that's something I'll look at in the future too. But you're right, not only with indigenous relationships with these beings, but also with nature itself. And a lot of that is lost in modern Western society. We don't respect the wildlife, the landscape, and certainly not these beings who we have decided don't exist. So it's so good to hear when, as you say, people and communities still are revering and communing with otherworldly beings, because I think it is, like you, I agree, it's a very healthy indicator.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to be at the beginnings of many of our world civilizations. When we're talking about Ireland in particular, I don't know how accurate this is or if I have it all correct, but the Tuatha De Danann, I believe that's how you pronounce them, they're kind of like these underworld, Fomorian, maybe is the other word associated with them, but these like underworld beings who aren't necessarily underworld in the sense of Greek Hades or Christian hell. They're more like what we're talking about here, where they're on this other side of the veil, this liminal boundary between the seen and the unseen realms. And our relationship with them has kind of been recorded in these folk tales and folklore, and even in the realms of the occult, different, I guess, deals you can make with these entities that may benefit or be to your detriment. The whole, like what Dara Mason talks about, the deal with the man at the crossroads, the dark man. There's something just on the precipice here. And I feel Irish culture in particular has preserved this ecosystem, if you will, better than any other culture, at least in the West, possibly.
Yeah, and the idea around that is that the Tuatha De Danann, and they had to then go underground because of they were battling with the Fomorians. And so if we look at it like that, and they did go underground in some way, there's also an idea that comes across in the medieval literature that they then had relationships with human beings. And so if they had relationships with human beings, and of course there's no evidence of this, but it's in the folklore, it's in the deep ancient tales, then there are supposed to be these families that were part fairy and that still exist in places like Scotland and in Ireland in particular. So that's really interesting too, how that's kind of come through, that if they exist, and I do believe that they do, then is there part of some of us? Is it possible that there are fairy lineages even in running through our societies? That's interesting to me. And of course, it can never really prove that either way, but I just think it's an interesting idea. That's another thread that runs through that keeps it alive. And what is it about Ireland? Because you're right, they've been able to preserve for the reasons that I gave with Reformation and industrialization, but there's something else about the Irish culture that is very alive and maybe sees the world in a different way to other cultures. And yeah, there's just something about that. I don't know what that is. It does feel like a very special place, and maybe a bed of where a lot of this magic in the world emanates from. So maybe I'm just biased because my family's Irish, so I could just being a bit romantic there, but it feels that way to me, that there's something about, and also that it's kind of given us the way in through this ancient literature which survives. And I just really hope that more manuscripts are found, and I do believe that they will. I just really hope, it's wishful thinking, I know, but it would be so wonderful if we just had more evidence, more remaining ancient text to pour through. That would just be such a gift, because we might learn some more.
Yeah.
You know, on top of what
we can. Yeah. Well, if we could only speculate, it's still, there's a lot to be said. And yeah, I think there's something very potent about Ireland. I recently came across some YouTube content that brought up the work of Michael Tsarion and Connor McDarry, another sort of lane altogether than from what we're talking about today, but they did talk about how Ireland is the sort of actual source of the Bible potentially, and that the Catholic Church altered it and shifted it to represent some more sort of Mediterranean centric ideas or Greek Roman centric ideas, when really they were basing a lot of this off of Isha, which I guess was the original name for Jesus. So That's a whole rabbit hole that I'm not prepared to present fully, but I do think that there's something inherently deeply connected, whether that's true or both are true, where some things happened in both places that were significant. It is very reminiscent of this sort of fallen angels idea where certain beings that were angelic in nature rebelled from God and then came and created daughters and sons with, mated with the daughters of man, I think is the exact phrase from the Bible. So it's sort of similar in your conversation with Brother Richard, which we brought up earlier. He does talk about Tolkien and C.S. Lewis being these sort of Christian folklorists who take a lot of this stuff, and it's not outside of the paradigm of Christianity. These sort of ideas do have a place. They may be very esoteric and not what your average church wants you to know about, but the truth is out there. It must include all of these things. That's at least my suspicion.
Yeah, I would love to get over to Ireland to speak to people myself and ask them about their own experiences. I'm sure there are people doing that, and I haven't seen anybody do exactly the kind of thing that I do, where it's more about meaning. So I would really just love to talk to people about that, because there's a huge taboo over there about talking about your fairy experiences, even more than it is in most places, because people are genuinely frightened. And through the kind of religious lens, they may be either frightened because there's just so much respect for the fairies that you don't even mention them. You certainly don't use the word fairies. You would use good people, the other crowd, and refer to them in that way. So scared because they believe in them and they don't want to offend, or scared because of the religious lens through which they see these beings, and they may see them as demons. And I know that is a similar situation in parts of America as well, and certain religious groups. But I feel like there's so much richness there to still be uncovered. And it would be wonderful to learn more and see. And of course, a lot of the country is still fairly rural compared to Britain anyway.
Right.
You have vast swathes of green here, but quite as much as there.
Yeah, I have yet to visit myself, and I think there's a lot of real magic to uncover, so I hope you do. But of course, yeah, there's sort of maybe a needed wrapping of protection around the whole topic, because, yeah, there's a lot of superstition, and maybe to protect these beings, right? Because the church has punished people for talking openly about it, so protects them as well as witnesses of this by being very quiet about it. But yeah, it's fascinating. Now, I know my audience is a mixed bunch, so there could be still some skeptical folks. And I'm curious if there's one or maybe any story that you've heard, firsthand encounter, that is more compelling or worth mentioning for those who might be a little bit still on the other side of the fence. Oh, this is interesting, but I'm not sure. Does any story stand out to you as really compelling and you really were moved by talking to this person about their encounter?
Well, first of all, if people are thinking of listening to the podcast, I think if you start with the first episode, that is a really compelling encounter, because there's, and I'll talk about it briefly because I'm going to talk about another one, but in that first, it's called A Remote Encounter. And this guy, he had a really responsible job, and I can't disclose what it was that he did, but he had an uber responsible job and was not airy fairy at all. And he had been going through quite a tough time in his life, and he'd gone off to the sort of furthest reaches of Scotland. And I don't give the locations in the research because I just want to protect the environment and protect the beings as well. So there he'd gone off, and he was on his way home one evening, and he came face to face with this naked kind of whitey grey skinned being that came up to about his shoulder height, and they just crossed paths, and this being was really frightened of him, and he didn't know what he was looking at. And the being ran one way and he went the other. And he was one of these types that had never really thought about fairies before, and it was astonished, and went back to his cabin where he was staying. And in the guest book, some children had written, I saw the gillydoo. He was in the front garden. So some children had seen something and written about it in the guest book. So he doesn't know if that's what they saw, the same thing, but it was interesting to him. So that's that one. But what really stands out to me is, I don't know if people are familiar with the work of Paul Devereux, and quite an amazing guy. I'm very lucky in that he, in fact, I don't think I've said this anyway yet, but he's going to be writing the foreword for my book, which I'm very excited about. So Paul has been researching. Initially, he kind of got interested in what they were calling ley lines way back in the 70s, kind of Alfred Watkins sort of continuing the research on that kind of view of ley lines. And then in recent years, or sort of from 80s onwards, I suppose, he's been more interested in the qualities of sacred sites like these, magnetism, radioactivity, all those sorts of things, and sound resonance as well. He's kind of been testing around sound resonance. And he's been very interested in what he was calling spirit paths, these ways through the landscape that seem to be kind of energy lines, not so much as ley lines, but lines that energy seems to travel along, and how they might be kind of connected to geophysical aspects in the landscape. So he had always considered that the belief in fairies was just tied into local culture, folklore, old stories. And in 2003, he was traveling around Ireland with his wife, Sharla, who is American. And they believe they were in County Mayo, and they were chasing up some stories about fairy paths. And I think they were due to speak to somebody that afternoon, and they were just trying to find his house. And so they're going along the road. This was the research for their book, Fairy Paths and Spirit Roads, which I think is now available as Spirit Roads. So he's going along, and they come to a Y junction where there's a kind of a grass. So if you go at the Y junction, there's like a grass triangle in the middle of that junction. And there's no signpost or anything. So they slowed right down to see where to go. And at that moment, on the grass junction bit, appeared this, what he described as like a bollard of foliage. It suddenly appeared. It had a head and a body, a very tightly wound foliage. And as he drove past slowly, this thing turned to look at them as they drove. And Sharla, his wife, saw eyes looking back at them from this foliage. So they both saw it. She initially let out an expletive, and he slammed on the brake, and they both said, "Did you see that?" And they'd both seen it. And I think he kind of stopped for a moment to gather his senses, and then he just kind of put his foot on the accelerator and he was out of there because he was absolutely terrified. She says that she wasn't frightened, but she was shocked because she said she'd had experiences before, like stuff where, have I seen something? Haven't I? Well, I'm not sure. It's probably nothing. But she'd never, ever had an experience like that with somebody else that saw it too. And so there was no escaping it. They both saw this being. And it has turned his life around in some respects because, as I say, he'd gone through all of this research of recent decades, just thinking, oh, it's just tradition. It's just folklore stuff. And actually, now he feels like he's on a mission to let people know that, no, it is true. No, it's not like he had that experience and then went straight out into the world and talked about it. It took him, like me, it took him a long time to actually process what he'd seen and what that meant for him. And he's only started really talking about it in the last sort of maybe five or six years. And he did come on to the podcast and talk about that with me. And I think that's somebody that has been a skeptic all their lives, and it's been in this area looking at it and still been a skeptic. And then it's taken seeing that to change his mind. And he has, his father's Irish as well. So he has Irish ancestry, which he did wonder if that played a part. I don't know about Sharla's ancestry, but because she saw it too. But that's a really interesting one to think that there are so many. I think what's really compelling is when you just talk to someone and hear their story, because you can really hear and see sometimes how moving it was for them and how it's changed them as people. And I think that speaks volumes when you're talking to somebody about something. It's often, as I say, a very sort of precious private experience. And they've kind of never been the same since having that experience. And they don't. It doesn't really happen like that. Did we freeze there for a little bit?
Yeah, we froze for just 5 seconds.
All right. Okay.
I missed what you just said.
Okay. So, yeah, just that what I think is interesting is that often the people that I speak to had never really had any interest or thought about fairies. People that really do want to see a fairy are very desperate to see a fairy, but it doesn't happen like that. Like, you can't really make it happen. I couldn't make it happen again. It has just happened. It has happened a number of times because I saw the tree man. And I guess I kind of, with one of my experiences, it was when I had gone out to the garden and I had been checking in, because I'd started the podcast then, and I was checking in to say, is this okay what I'm doing? Which I do from time to time. I will kind of check in and is this still something that, you know, I'm being asked to do, kind of thing. And fully up for a response. If the response was no, then I would pack things down, because I would only do this if it feels right. So anyway, I'd gone out. And I was more sort of speaking towards my garden and the beings that might be in the garden as a way to connect with other world. But actually, this completely different kind of being came in to, so I'm there meditating, and they came in with a cold wind, and they were a tall, glowing figure. I've never had an experience like that before. Now, this isn't me sitting there with my eyes open. This is in meditation, but I felt the breeze come in, the coldness, and I saw this tall, glowing man. And he motioned to me towards an area of land. And this was in lockdown, because it was at the time where you could only go a certain distance from your home. And this place was kind of within that distance. And so I decided to go and explore it. And when I did, I then found out that it was up for development, and there was only a few days to write a letter to the local council to stop that being developed, which I did. So I always think that they must have motioned me to do that to protect that landscape. And I fully understand lots of people will think, oh, well, that wasn't because you were meditating. But anyone that meditates and gets into these states knows what I'm talking about here. When you have those really, I mean, they don't happen often, do they? But when they happen, you know about it.
Right.
So yeah, that was very unexpected. And that's the only time where I have gone to sort of reach out and it's happened.
Well, and I think I get the point you're illustrating, which is that you can't force it. You can maybe you can put yourself in the right position to receive it, but you know, whether or not there's going to be something to meet you on the other end isn't necessarily up to you, but it does seem indicative of being on the right path and also being in the right place at the right time to help, because it's not a one-sided affair. A lot of people, I think, the reason they don't have interactions is because maybe somewhere deep down, and I might be guilty of this, maybe they're seeking something from those experiences that those experiences aren't willing to give them. And they need to be more ready to receive what these experiences are willing to give them rather than expecting something, right? Like at least here in America, we have we're raised with these sort of entitlement issues. It's sort of a byproduct of capitalism and soft parenting, and then how that's affected the government school system and all of that. I mean, it's just the people are really out of touch with nature in general. But I think, this could be a part of it where we sort of move around the landscape as consumers rather than people in a relationship with our environment, which is what we should be aspiring to be in harmony with our relationship rather than to be dominant over it.
Yeah, no, it's exactly the same here, by the way. But I think if people feel like, you know, I think a good place to start is just to make friends with an environment, find somewhere that you feel drawn to, that you can get to easily, maybe that's within reach, and just start forming a relationship with that place and then to see what happens, because something starts to happen and I think you feel a lot happier for it too, even if, as I say, you don't get a big kind of wow moment of seeing another worldly being. You start to, as I say, open to a point where nature can reach out to you too. So if you kind of go there and pick up litter or whatever, that's a really great start. Just going there and quietly contemplating or meditating, and all these things that form that bond. And then I guess just see what happens from there. But that is something I think that we are moving back to as Western societies, for sure. We're sort of peered over the precipice and realized how close we are to losing what we have and what really is of value. And so if some are still kind of going along, kidding themselves that it's all about what they can have and how much they have and all of that sort of thing, yeah, I think that the vast majority of people are not like that and are starting to realize what really is important.
Well said. Well, I think you're putting together a great repository of these experiences for people to understand how available this other side of the veil just may be. And if we attune ourselves appropriately, yeah, maybe we can become in harmony with these things and our environment. So I applaud your podcast. I think it's very unique, and I hope being on my show helps you find maybe new audiences and, who knows, maybe even new experiencers that will reach out to you and want to tell you their story. Is there a place people can reach out to you if they have an encounter that they'd like to share?
Oh, so my email is scarletofthefae@gmail.com. So that's scarlet with two T's at gmail.com. And yeah, and I am on Instagram at _remain_curious. And I also have a website, scarletofthefae.com. So yeah, people can reach out there. I'm on Twitter, but not really. And I still haven't made it onto Blue Sky or anything like that. I just kind of stick to Instagram. And I've kind of got my head down writing at the moment, so I'm a bit rubbish with admin. I will get back to people, but sometimes it takes me a little while to get back to people. So just bear that in mind for the moment. Just trying to get this book finished. And then also we have a really nice Patreon, a really lovely community of people. And so that's just a nice place to come and kind of chat about things too. But there's also some free stuff, like freely available and accessible on Patreon, where people can access meditations. So you don't have to join Patreon to get to those. So if they want to just go along there and have a go at some of the meditations there, then they are very welcome to do that. And I hope that helps some folks. But yeah, that's about it, I think, in terms of, oh, of course, YouTube. Yes, that's the other thing. So I've got a channel on YouTube, so there too. And it would be great to have you on for a chat when I'm finished the book and I'm caught up with myself a bit, perhaps towards the end of the year. It'd be really nice. You know, I've really enjoyed this chat.
Thank
with you. And yeah, great questions. And it's been really nice.
Thank you. I'd be happy to join you on the show. Although I don't have an encounter, I maybe be able to talk more about the geomancy and the landscape energies and things that I've been researching in that vein. So yeah, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Oh, really cool.
And yeah, I encourage my audience to check out your show. You have some great interviews, and I didn't realize you had had spoke to Paul Devereaux on the show. I'll have to go and look that up because I'm a big fan of his work. So yeah, lots of great stuff. She's interviewed folks that we've talked to, Dara Mason, Joshua Cutchin, and Brother Richard really moved me. I really liked that interview with him. I hope you talk to him again and if there's a chance to, because yeah, he's very interesting. So thank you so much, Joe. I appreciate it. And I'd be happy to have you back on as well to talk about your book when it is out so we can help promote it and get it to the people. So be in touch and let me know when that is available for purchase. And I look forward to that. But until next episode, folks, go and check out the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, and that was our conversation with Joe Hickey Hall. Remember, folks, you can support the podcast and get a completely ad-free version of the podcast, as well as bonus episodes and extensions to episodes like this one by signing up on the Patreon, patreon.com/mftic, or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. And if you sign up on the Patreon, when we hit 500 Patreons, I am going to give out a $250 Amazon gift card. So you don't want to miss out on that. Sign up now and you'll hear the extended outro of this episode where I get into some strange and unrelated but somewhat related supernatural fairy lore type tales. So join me over there on the Patreon where you get all sorts of bonus material, episodes, early releases, the video version of the show completely ad-free, and so much more. Sign up there today. Go and check out Joe Hickey Hall at the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast, wherever you listen to this podcast, or you can find her website, scarletofthefae.com. That's scarletofthefae, FAE.com, wherever you browse the web. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mystic Mark. I'd love to see you over on the Patreon. We just opened up the Discord and so many other interesting benefits, perks to being a supporter. So join me over there and I'll see you on the next episode. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home. This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.